Hello and welcome. This latest episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff provides an extremely welcome return for Newcastle University's legendary registrar, Dr. John Hogan. Back in episode 9, John and I talked, among other things, about stuff such as the impact of cuts in the 1980s, the experience of working at the University of Warwick, life under lockdown, and the financial challenges ahead for the sector. This time, John once again demonstrates his passion for effective university management across a wide range of areas and recalls some recent experiences as well as a few issues from the past. We explore the very different start to this academic term, noting that there are very many fewer student COVID cases, but many challenges remain, although vaccination rates are high. The issue of collaboration versus competition in the sector prompts much debate, as does the nature of university marketing operations, and John's particular irritation at our spend on online advertising. We look too at the growth over time in professional staff numbers, and also so-called administrative bloat, noting that much of this is in response to external regulatory demands from which universities often aim to insulate academics and students. The culture of administration is an area of great interest for John, and in particular his concern that we don't need to be brilliant with some activities, just legally compliant, in order to minimise the additional burden on the university. You'll be pleased to note he has a number of slightly controversial observations on this issue too. Finally, we look back at a major change project at Newcastle some years ago to which John contributed, the move of professional services from a warren of terraced houses to a shiny new building much more focused on providing a better service for students and a better working environment for staff, as well as reducing the number of doors between the registrar and the HR director from 23 to a slightly more sensible level. John lauds the nature and role of universities as amazing transformational places where he's worked throughout his career. And sadly for all of us, he has recently announced his retirement in 2022. The sector will be much less interesting without his presence. So I hope you enjoy this episode of John and I talking about stuff. Welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. John Hogan, Registrar at the University of Newcastle. Now, John, you will remember from last time when we spoke to him all about his experience at Newcastle in the pandemic, but also some great nostalgia trips back to the 80s and the funding cuts there. But he is such a good colleague and indeed such good value to talk to, and I wanted to catch up a bit more with him to make sure that I got some more out of him. So John, welcome back. It's great to see you again, and I hope you're keeping well.
Yes, thanks Paul, thanks for inviting me back. Yes, well, thanks, and so far, and we'll come on to this, so far I'm delighted to say most of our students seem to be well as well.
Well, let's talk about that, because we've started our new session. At the time of recording, we're a couple of weeks into the new term. So how has it been for you compared with last time?
Well, so far it's remarkably easier than we had expected. So this time last year, we had 1 week where we had over 1,000 COVID cases amongst our students. In our most recent figures for last week, we had 8 student confirmed cases. Wow. Now, before we declare this pandemic over, which it is a long way from being, we have to take this with a bucket load of salt. I've got no doubt that those 8 cases out of our 29,000 students is an example of underreporting. Yeah. In the same period, out of our 6,500 staff, we had 27 confirmed staff cases. Now, it doesn't make any sense to think that there could be such a mismatch in the populations. And you've got to then try to scratch away about what's happening with our student and our staff communities. And I think it's reasonable to assume that some of our students might have COVID and probably it's fairly mild and they're not too bothered. Hopefully they are self-isolating. They may not be bothering to get a PCR test. But there are some risks, but it is a remarkably low figure. Now, amongst staff, the 27 is higher than the comparative period last year. And this is a worry. Now, our view is that it's probably school children related as much as anything. So we have had right. quite a few examples of colleagues falling ill with COVID where they have children coming back into the house from school. And often in those cases, the child themselves is you know, mild sniffles at worst, which is a relief. I have to say that cases, those 27 cases, all those 27 people were double vaccinated. So yeah. the vaccination, as we all know, helps reduce the likelihood of more serious illness. It's not a perfect defense against catching yeah. COVID in the yeah. first place. What I think it does prove, Paul, undoubtedly, as some of us have known for a while now, is that children are dangerous.
Well, that's a perspective, John, that hasn't quite, you know, had the national headlines you might perhaps prefer. But I mean, certainly that I think that situation, though, is replicated across the country. And it does feel bizarre, given what we all went through this time last year, to have staff cases higher than student cases. What I don't know what your experience is, but our experience at Nottingham, at both universities in Nottingham, is that student vaccination rates, bearing in mind they've only relatively recently younger people been able to get the vaccine, are actually extraordinarily high and much Absolutely. Better than the comparable youth population in the city, which I find enormously encouraging.
Very much so, Paul. So we're well over 95%, and less than 1% of our students that we surveyed have declared they will not get vaccinated. And some of those will have medical reasons for not to be vaccinated. Yeah. So overwhelmingly, our students are doing the right thing in terms of vaccination. And on the same point, it is alarming to see that the percentage of those over 50 who have still not been fully vaccinated. Now, we haven't done the same survey amongst staff. We are, of course, promoting the benefits of vaccination. But the general population over 50, it's still far from perfect, which I fear is one of the reasons why we're seeing the death roll increase tragically. I mean, the anti-vaxxers, I'm afraid, for anyone who believes this nonsense, they're costing lives.
It is frightening, isn't it? And it's part of that, you know, a trend we've seen of the kind of anti-science narrative. Exactly. And, it links to the government messages around not trusting experts and all the rest of it. And it is deeply, deeply distressing. But it also plays into the kind of the culture wars issues as well, doesn't it? In terms of the way in which there is this kind of stoking of anti-university sentiment as well. It's all connected, isn't it?
I'm afraid so. And it is one of the more difficult agendas for the universities, how we are engaging effectively, because I think, you know, Derry mentioned Brexit in the same discussion as COVID. Everyone would have turned off by now. But it comes back to the fact that overwhelmingly university colleagues wanted to remain in Europe, and by a small margin, the general vote went against. Yeah. So it is a problem. Let me say one other thing about the COVID situation at the moment. We're pleased with the low infection rates amongst students. We are still cautious. This is a long way from being over. As we're speaking, the government must clearly be contemplating going back to Plan B. We have various other COVID protection measures in place. The most difficult at the moment to try to maintain and enforce has been the wearing of face coverings in teaching environments.
Yeah.
And I catch the train in every day, and increasingly now people are not wearing a face covering on the train, and you know we're on a losing agenda here when I hear the ticket collector announce please wear your face covering and then proceed up the train uncovered themselves. You just think, well, hang on a minute. This is not going to work. And I suspect universities are one of the few areas where we are trying to enforce face coverings. The students do respond when asked, but they are increasingly requiring prompting and the handing out of free face coverings and so on. Our colleagues are nervous about this. They're aware of the numbers. They're aware there's a risk. We've not had cases in any large extent of on-campus transmission throughout the normal working practices.
Yeah.
So the cases, both amongst colleagues and students, overwhelmingly are related to their social domestic activities.
No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that's been the case for some time. It's been harder to evidence it until recently. I think the face covering thing is really interesting because you do reach a kind of tipping point where if the majority aren't, then actually the minority who are just start thinking, well, what's the point? And I feel in large parts of society, certainly outside universities, we've passed that point in England anyway. I think it's still different in other parts of the UK, where the different rules have applied for longer. So that may well come in as part of Plan B. But the enforcement thing, I think, is challenging, right? Because, you know, it is very difficult if it's not the law, and even if it is the law, you know, to enforce it. And it's tough. And students, you know, will not necessarily agree with what, you know, an academic or a librarian or a security guard is telling them to do, or God forbid, a registrar.
Well, absolutely, Paul. And this is the problem of trying to do something which is not being enforced elsewhere. So, confession time, I went to a concert the other day. I won't name the group because that really will age me.
Oh, come on.
No. But what I will say is at City Hall, and it was not entirely sold out, but it was pretty good. And the venue was very good about requiring proof of vaccination or COVID test. Prior to entry, they did good checks on that and on the tickets, of course. And they had advised face coverings, but when, of course, you got in, there were virtually nobody. And perhaps critically, the group themselves weren't wearing face coverings, although my wife was with me at some stage, probably wished they were. I thought the concert was brilliant, by the way.
Oh, good. Well, you will tell me afterwards
Afterwards.
who it was, or I could just look it up, I guess.
Probably.
No, so I mean, I think you're right. So it's a different start to the session. I mean, the other thing that we've we found is that the relationships that we built up with our various partners, including the police and public health and whatever, have definitely been sustained, and they feel stronger than ever. And I think certainly in Nottingham we found that to be really, really positive. And public health in particular have been praising students for their behaviour, which, given where we were last year, where students were being accused of all sorts of things, which deeply unfair, and they were being unfairly maligned, is feels like a really important and refreshing change.
I completely agree. I mean, it's been a great relief for the sector that there's been no spike that we're aware of resulting from university students travelling to or travelling back to their university. So that's a relief. And as I say, the infection rates amongst students seem to be much lower than the general population. I think you made this point earlier, Paul, that even amongst the young cohort, it's lower amongst students.
So it's been a good start to the session then, John. And there are many other things that we're all grappling with, and we're kind of facing a number of big challenges, I think, in the sector as we go forward. And there's anxieties about, at the time we're speaking, what's going to be in the comprehensive spending review. But one of the things I wanted to ask you was about the nature of the way in which the sector works. Because yes, we've all come together over COVID and we've been all terribly collaborative, right? And that's been great. And we are, instinctively collaborative. But everything, from for the over the past, arguably over the past 30 years, but certainly very, very much so since the Higher Education Research Act 2017, it's been very much about driving competition more into the sector, and getting new universities to come up and challenge existing established universities. And I know you've got thoughts on it, but I mean,
Yes.
it's been a there has been an inexorable drive towards what people often call marketization of higher education. I think it's possibly a bit simplistic,
Yes.
but the adoption of more commercial techniques in order to recruit students. And you could say, well, you've got to do that in order to engage with young people where they're at, but also it does actually create that kind of competitive edge, which militates against collaboration.
Yeah, this is something I feel quite strongly about, Paul, and I realise it's easy to oversimplify this. But fundamentally, I don't accept that the market will drive up the quality and standards of higher education provision. I think we, over the years, have benefited enormously, in my view, through good collaboration and good understandings, network of professional staff, for example, the Association of University Administrators. These are valuable organizations, the Association of Heads of University Administration, which we're both members of. We get a lot when we're able to discuss with colleagues from other organizations, other universities, other HEIs, how things are done, what works well, what doesn't work well. Now, we, thank goodness, we haven't got to the stage where we say, well, I can't possibly tell you that because it's, you know, so we do still pretty openly discuss problems and issues, and I think we benefit enormously. But we are being increasingly driven towards a more competitive style of approach. And again, easy to exaggerate, but marketing, we have some fantastic colleagues working here in marketing, really skilled. But if I'm honest, and I hope they don't mind me saying this, it irritates the living daylights out of me that we are spending money on Google Ads, as indeed many other universities are. I mean, that's fantastic for Google, isn't it? I mean, they're short of a penny or two, I'm told. So, you know, keep going. Now that, and the reason we're doing this, of course, is we're competing. So if you type in, of course, your everyone's Google search engines, when they listen to this, will be based on their own research preferences. But if you type in, I don't know, engineering degrees or so on, you will undoubtedly come up with some institutions that are currently paying for Google to put them right at the top of that list. And okay, that, you know, it's a choice, but we've got to remember that the source of that funding does come from the student fee originally, and it was never and it's a tiny fraction of the fee, let's not exaggerate this too much, but it was never intended really that the student fee would be diverted even modestly into vast increase in marketing spend, which we have had to see, and we understand why. We are, there's no controls on student numbers with exceptions of some subject areas, so we are all living and breathing based on that round of recruitment, international, home, and we all watch these figures, and the old saying about there used to be recruiting universities and admitting universities, we know that with very few exceptions that's changed. We're all essentially recruiting now, and we have to, you know, compete.
Yeah.
The elements of that do frustrate me. You could tell I'm a bit old-fashioned on this one.
I know. Well, no, I mean, and of course there will be many, including your colleagues in marketing, who will say we spend far too little on on that kind of thing, you know, compared with, you know, the commercial sector where they'll spend, you know, 15% of their budget on this kind of thing. But there are people in the sector, and indeed many of my colleagues, you know, who you know, bemoan the passing of the Ronio machine, where they could just, you know, turn out a typewritten leaflet, which they would, you know, then hand inscribe and pass on to a prospective student. And, you know, there is an element of that, that nostalgia from the idea that you can develop a personal relationship with an applicant and then see them through, you know. But in a mass system, I just don't think that works, right? So that, you know, part of this is a response to a mass system, it seems to me. But I do think there are elements of it though, John, that are positive from the point of view of the applicant, right? You know, the focus on the applicant from you know, where the customer stuff works well, right, is where you see the applicant as a person, as someone who needs to be nurtured and engaged with and supported through their journey to you as a university, right? So you can use the techniques of the marketer in order to build that relationship more effectively, right, and to help someone make a good decision, right? And it isn't just about getting them in the door and bums on seats, it's about, you know, trying to get the right people for the right courses in your institution. So I think there are positive elements, but I do absolutely get what you're saying. I mean, the idea of just chucking more money at Facebook and Google appalls me equally. I don't like it.
What you've just said is a very important corrective to my initial rant. These are very good points. And I do think, in fairness to the higher fee regime, that it has increased attention to that sort of issue on the student journey. And one of the points I hope is true, the worst outcome for any of us with students is to admit someone who then subsequently fails. And of course it happens, yeah. You know, dropout rate and so on. And sometimes it's for non-academic reasons, which are unavoidable. We know that that's not the outcome any of us want. So there is still, I would trust, a degree of mutual interest in trying to align what the applicant hopes to achieve from their degree program with what the organization, the university, seeks to offer. And if there's a violent mismatch, then it will actually hurt not only the applicant, unfortunately, but it also will hurt the institution.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a desperate waste from everyone's perspective, you know, a waste of talent and opportunity, as well as a waste of investment and finance, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's lost time in someone's life. So I absolutely agree. And, you know, our universities, our sector's dropout rates on the whole are pretty good. It's something that I know that the government and the OFS get anxious about in parts. But, you know, actually, the big picture, I think, is that it's something that we do, you know, the recruitment of the right people and the retention and the efforts we go to retain people whilst maintaining standards, I think is very, very powerful. And that's one of the reasons we've got the reputation we have. Can I kind of a related topic then, John? I mean, we you know, the growth of, you know, the you know, marketing and recruitment activity, right, exemplifies a kind of another critique that we often get within our universities and indeed from outside about the growth in the professional cadre of staff who are required in order, you know, so people, you know, like us who are, you know, seem to be required in all sorts of new jobs that didn't exist in universities 30 years ago. And, you know, in US universities, that, you know, this is described rather unpleasantly, I always think, as administrative bloat.
Yeah.
Right. They're often actually referring to, you know, actually academic leadership roles in that. But nevertheless, the general principle is true, is that is more being spent on more people who aren't involved in teaching and research, right, who are doing fundamentally leadership, management, administrative roles. So there has been a growth, undoubtedly, right? You know, and I think there are, you know, there are elements of justification you can have for that about the nature of the regulatory environment,
yes,
you know, the pressure on the need to have marketing, et cetera, et cetera. What, I mean, I know you've thought about this before, but what's your take on that growth? Is it justifiable?
So I've spent all my professional life working in higher education, what perhaps used to be called administration and perhaps increasingly called management. So that's my environment. So, of course, I'm passionate about it. I'm passionate about the services that we provide. I'm passionate about the people that we help. It's a vital part of any successful university is to have high caliber professional staff dealing with a whole range of enormously complicated and sophisticated issues, many of which do not touch the sides, thank goodness, of our academic community. I say thank goodness because they shouldn't have to be troubled. They should not have to be worried about our VAT returns or even our FOI responses, etc. You know, there's an enormous amount when any organization that just has to be done, and that has undoubtedly increased. Undoubtedly. So I know FOIs is one of your favorite topics, so we shouldn't get diverted too much onto that.
I was just getting
yeah, no, we mustn't.
We shouldn't have mentioned
so it. I think, yes, it is a complicated environment. We have enormous responsibilities and we increasingly rely on professional staff to deliver a whole range of activities, including, of course, increasingly sort of the third strand professional where they do contribute what may traditionally be described as teaching, but certainly directly to the educational experience of our students. And that can be anything from the library through to careers, through to learning and teaching development services. So it's a complicated pattern out there. And the sort of skills I was originally trained in have become less valued. So, you know, fine tuning a minute is no longer regarded as perhaps the pinnacle of the skill set of a registrar.
Shame.
You say shame. I'm actually quite relieved because my minutes were never that good. Terrible confession. But so things have changed enormously. And But what I would say, and this is a slightly awkward comment, which may not land terribly well with your potential listeners. We have to accept that when you employ another member of professional services, it doesn't actually reduce the administrative work. It actually increases it. Now this is a slightly dangerous comment to make, but I'll explain. There are tasks which are have to be done, and either, you know, frankly, professional services do it, or the academic community has to do it. Take admissions, for example. Increasingly, we've seen the actual decision on a UCAS form being transferred away from the academic community through to professional services operating with, you know, almost a call center style of management, with clear guidelines set by the academic community we trust. And it's, you know, the volumes of applications we're getting requires this sort of production line or approach. But that sounds rather callous, and because I'd come back to your earlier comments in this discussion, that it's not done badly. It's actually the opposite. It's actually with considerable care and attention to the applicant's journey, yeah, in a way in, yeah, which it used to be idiosyncratic, and, you know, sometimes it was brilliant, other times it was disastrous. There's a more universal, higher standard applied. So, yeah, these are good things. But even if you're a member of the team that, I don't know, recruits international students or whatever, by taking on another member of staff, you are, of course, increasing the administrative load for other people, including people's services, maybe finance, etc. So the truism is that the more professional staff you employ, the greater the administrative load becomes, because those people themselves generate stuff. You know, if you are in a professional services role, you inevitably create work for others. So you, and I don't mean that negatively, but I think it is important that we grasp this point, that we are in organizations now where perhaps most of our employees are not frontline teaching and research. They are still, I would argue, doing absolutely vital roles, but we just have to keep our heads clear that this can get to a stage where it actually alienates our academic community. And this is a bit of a painful set of issues, but I will say something which, again, not everyone will welcome. I find some of our approaches to education, the quality assurance and so on, extraordinarily difficult to understand. Now, and I don't understand their benefit. They don't seem to...
Give me an example, John.
Well, all right, this is very painful for Newcastle, and I regret having to broadcast this, but we did not do well in the National Student Survey. We did badly. Now, of course, COVID...
Well, you along with every other...
Yeah, okay. COVID hit the entire sector badly, but even allowing for that, we did, you know, we were upset. We will do better. We will absolutely bounce back. But you've got to ask yourself, why did we do so badly, given we have a whole range of quality assurance processes and so on, annual monitoring, student feedback? Why did this come as a bit of a nasty shock? And the answer must be that a lot of these things go ahead and have no net benefit whatsoever, but are done in the past because, you know, we were required to do it to meet the quality thresholds. And to be fair to the OFS, again, Paul, something you never thought would be said during one of your discussions, but to be fair to the OFS, they have said you can, you know, more or less do what you like on quality assurance now. It's up to you how you deliver it, but just make sure it's good. But we haven't grasped that. We've still maintained our pre-OFS approach to this. We still have a whole range of control processes in place, module approvals, module outlines, et cetera, which I suspect many of our academic colleagues who do actually end up delivering much of the education experience find bureaucratic and annoying. And at its worst, I think it actually alienates the community.
I get that. And you could say, well, let's look at all that. Let's strip it, yeah, back to the barest essence that mean that we're meeting, you know, the QAA requirements and indeed, you know, the expectations of the OFS in terms of the outcomes of those processes. I would suggest that wouldn't necessarily either liberate huge amounts of time or indeed joy in the academic community. And I would be concerned that the response to that would be a kind of a return to greater unevenness in terms of the quality of provision, right? So you would have people who were much more diligent about it, but others who just didn't bother because they knew they'd get away with it. So I think I would have an anxiety about that. But I would also contend that actually it's not, we come to an accommodation with all of that, right? We can do it in a streamlined way, I would suggest, because we're familiar and comfortable with it. Whereas we keep getting layer upon layer of new stuff being thrown at us, right, on top of everything else. And we know that, you know, new free speech laws are coming down the track. So are we going to have, you know, someone else that we're going to have to bring in order to look at this? In the same way as we've got more people looking at UKVI, obviously we've got more people dealing with data protection and FOI and more specialists who, you're right, they do generate more work. But we are having to do this because of the regulation that's been imposed on us.
Yeah.
In other words, not my fault, Gov.
No, Paul, I agree. I think one of the issues, which is, again, tricky for professional services, is that we do tend to do things well. You know, so we try our best to comply. So we do try to respond to FOI. Sometimes it's very difficult and very time consuming. But we do.
Yeah.
And
we're good citizens. I think that's
this again is another very tricky comment, which I don't know how it will land. But one of the things about being in professional services, I feel very passionate about service provision. So I want people to do really well and respond well to students, to academic colleagues and so on. And because that's, you know, fundamentally why we're here, or one of the fundamental reasons why we're here. But there are things, and the consequence of that is that very often people feel that they've got a lot of pressure on and they could do a much better job with much more staff, much more resource. And I think that's undoubtedly true. But one of the arts of, I think, good units is that balance between service provision, which is good enough, and against that, which might possibly be the best in the world. Because, again, let's stick with FOIs. I want our FOI policies responses to be legally compliant and appropriate. I do not want them. I do not want this university to be known as the best university in the world in its responses to freedom of information. That's not a league table I want to see us anywhere near the top at. I don't want to be at the bottom of it, but I don't want to be at the top. Now, we've got some very good professionals working here. And one of the issues here is that they are dedicated to that task. So in the olden days, Paul, of course, we might have had a generalist who just spent a few hours a week dealing with them. But the scale of the enterprise now, the number of FOIs demands, and the complexity of the law, I have to say, demands dedicated professionals.
I think that's absolutely right, John. And it's it comes back to, I think, the kind of culture of the professional services as a whole that you try and engender. It's much harder, you know, than it used to be, I think, to try and develop that culture. But it's about enabling people to see the big picture, right?
Yes.
So it's about understanding where your role and your responsibilities fit in, right? You know, we are all here to support academic colleagues delivering teaching and research to ensure that students have a great experience, etc., right? And actually what we're trying to do is, as you say, protect our academic colleagues from having to worry about this kind of nonsense as well as we can, and also to insulate students against the worst excesses of this stuff and to prevent the whole university getting bogged down in nonsense, right? I mean, you know, that's what we're trying to do. But if you don't appreciate that, right, you will be trying to develop the best system for responding to subject access requests you possibly can, right? But unless you recognize that's not actually in the institutional interest, not in the interest of students and staff or whatever, right? So getting that big picture is really right. So in your experience, then, and I'm asking you this in a very particular context, right? Because I know that, you know, you've recently announced your retirement, which is, you know, a shock to all of us in the sector. But looking back on this, I mean, what is your feeling about that kind of you know, kind of ethos of professional services, of administration, as we used to call it, has it gone? I mean, is it possible to sustain it in this new world?
I absolutely do not think it's gone. Pre-COVID, we ran a hugely successful professional services conference, really bringing colleagues together, and some of my colleagues who prepared all that did a fantastic job. Now, COVID then stopped that. We would hope to get back to it. And when we do put on these generic activities, we get great responses from regardless of the particular domain that the professional occupies. So it's not gone. And one of the odd things about universities, the terrible truisms, and this is not an original thought, and so I forgive the plagiarism, but a terrible truism is that academic staff hate the university and love their job, whereas professional services staff hate their job and love the university. And outrageous exaggeration, but there's a kernel there that our academic colleagues are so brilliant at what they do that, of course, that occupies their attention. Whereas very often, because many of the roles are particular, the roles can be a little defined, but the organization for which we work is amazing. We are an organization, we transform lives for the better. And there aren't many organizations that can really say that. I mean, look, go back to the degree ceremony. I'd forgive you if I'm repeating a point that's come up previously, but one of the great things about degree ceremonies is, of course, you get the graduation pictures appearing in homes, and you can know when you walk into someone's home and there's that picture of their child, graduation ceremony. It's a classic, modern classic, Paul, and we make that happen.
I think that's absolutely right. And trying to remind people of that at every opportunity is I think really important. So it's really vital not to forget that, and that kind of bigger purpose. So without wishing to rehearse, you know, how many years you've worked in the sector, etc. I mean, I was just interested in you know, again, when you kind of look back and you think about the kind of some of the big challenges you face and some of the big things that you've been required to deliver. So are there kind of big things that you will look back and say, yeah, I was part of that. I helped make that happen. And that actually made a bit of a difference.
I think 2 points, Paul. I think that's a very good way of describing part of. Yes, I might have had my name on a document at certain stages and that sort of thing. But everything is a team effort, and I think that's really important to acknowledge. So lots of pairs of hands do lots of pairs of work, lots of activity. The other thing I'd say is that there's a sort of bit of a myth about university senior executives, and indeed executive boards, senior management teams, and governing bodies for that matter. And that the myth is that we come together and we suddenly have this great plan, and it transforms the organization overnight. Now there are of course big strategic decisions to be taken, and they need to be followed through, and they can of course make a huge difference typically in the long run. But more often than not, university management, senior management, even council, is about taking a series of relatively small decisions that build upon each other and point in a coherent direction, you know, come back to this idea of the strategy as a compass that point in the strategic direction. And that's what I want to say about, you know, the big issues, that often, yes, they are there, but it's cumulative and they can be built up over time. And you can cause quite a lot of difficulty with relatively minor decisions as well.
Yeah.
But to come back to the sort of, I don't know whether it would be a headline act, but one of the things I think I will look back fondly on is my time at Newcastle with regards to the accommodation occupied by professional services. So when I first started in, well, let's say there's 2002 here, for those of you who visited Newcastle before the last decade and a little bit, we occupied a series of terraced houses, Kensington and Park Terrace. And office in number 6 was somebody's bedroom at one stage, or at least.
They'd moved the bed out, had they?
Well, they had, thank goodness. Yeah. We'd redecorated a little bit. But fundamentally, it was still a series of terrace houses with the adjoining walls knocked through, with all sorts of stairs and narrow corridors. and I'm not joking about this, because I counted on occasion, there were 23 doors between my office and the then director of HR. She put in three of them after I started. That bit's the joke. She did. But there were 23 doors, other staircases as well. And it was a, in addition, for professional services, if you wanted to access careers, you went to one building. If you wanted to access accommodation, you went to another. Finance, you went to a third. We had at least seven different doors for students to enter. And when we moved to building where I'm currently speaking from, which is called Kingsgate, in 2010. Now, a lot of that was based on providing a service for students, a center for students, with the other parts of the administration built on top.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to try to avoid the phrase one-stop shop, because I don't fully believe that you can achieve a one-stop shop.
No.
You can put a lot together, which is desirable, but it would, and I know some universities have done remarkable things in terms of a sort of coherent opportunity for streamlining services and provisions, including things like assessment, handing in assessment and so on electronically. Yeah. But I still would maintain there are many, many doors at university and many doors that students have to knock on. And not all of them come to the professional services. So it's not a one-stop shop. It's a more coherent set of services that we've offered for many years now. And that's probably one of the things I'll look back fondly on.
Good. I mean, I think that those kind of developments can be transformative in the way that people see, you know, look through the lens of service delivery, rather than just thinking, well, you know, I've got my office in the bedroom, this isn't brilliant. But it does undoubtedly help to have a kind of professional offering which enables students to, you know, it takes some of the friction out of the university experience for students and enables them to get on with the stuff they actually want to do. And I think that benefits staff as well, right?
Yes.
And, you know, and all the benefits of, you know, collaborative working are enabled by that kind of space that simply aren't possible in your warren of terraced houses, which of course are common in larger numbers of universities. I mean, you know, lots of universities still have that kind of facility. But I bet you're damn glad you're not in there anymore.
Very much so. Yeah, there were two things I think, Paul, that from memory, many universities had. One was a set of Nissen huts. We're sort of post-war type thing. The science faculty occupied for decades, and the other was a series of terrace houses which were repurposed for university use. And we have put those terraces back to, I think, their best use for university, which is student accommodation, and very nice it is too. So someone is now sleeping in my office.
Again.
Yeah, again. Oh.
But I mean, there's just as we kind of approach the end, John, I mean, I think there is an issue there about you don't want to be seen to be, you know, kind of feather bedding the administration, right? There is always an issue about looking like you're providing better facilities for professional staff than for students or academics or researchers or whatever. And that's always a risk, isn't it? But if you don't do that, then you end up just leaving people in the Nissen huts, don't you?
Paul, this is a very sensitive issue, and perhaps I should have explained this a bit further. The building at this stage, at that stage, was about £33 million, which was an enormous sum of money. I mean, going back over a decade. Yeah. And yes, we were vulnerable to those criticisms. Where I think we moderated the criticisms was by emphasizing the ability of this physical configuration to provide a better service to students. And that has helped a great deal over the years. Where, of course, it now post-COVID, or in COVID still, feels a little bit more awkward, because we went for open plan big time. And so it's our biggest configuration of open plan. And like every other organization with large open plan, we have had challenges over the last 18 months or so. So lots of screens have reappeared, that sort of thing. We're getting back to greater use now. But as we said earlier, this pandemic's a long way from over. So there's still maybe some twists along the way.
I'm sure there will be. Well, you've had many twists along the way in your long and distinguished career, John. And I know that you know, you've got a wee while to go yet, which is great. But I mean, you've been an enormous figure in the sector, and for many of us, we've looked up to you and valued your support and guidance over the years. And I'm sure there'll be many opportunities to thank you for all that you've done in the months ahead. But you know, from me personally, I did want to say, you know, put on the record my thanks to you. You've been a super colleague and advisor and mentor and guide over the years, and I'm enormously grateful for all the support that you've given me personally during that time. So I'm and for the opportunity to speak to you again, which I'm really humbled and
grateful for those comments. Thank you.
But we'll miss you, although I'm sure you'll still be around somehow, you know. I'm sure you will be.
Well listen, John, I will say, Paul, that it's colleagues like you that really make higher education special. I mean, fantastic.
Yeah, I'll take that in a positive way, John. Thank you. Absolutely. That's very, very kind. And before we get too much backslapping about this, but thank you again, John. It's been fantastic to talk to you and to hear some more about Newcastle and also about your career and thoughts on the sector. Thanks again.
Thanks, Paul.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.